The long simmering dispute between Honolulu's taxi companies and ride-sharing services Uber and Lyft came to a head yesterday with Mayor Kirk Caldwell's veto of Bill 35, a measure that would have regulated so-called surge pricing by ride-sharing companies and made them subject to increased regulation. Here's what the mayor said at his news conference.
The council now has twice approached this issue and tried to find a way through it where the old technology could maybe exist along with the new ride-sharing technology. And how do we find that balance? And unfortunately, I believe that the bill that they passed, Bill 35, does not find that balance. And so I'm going to be vetoing that bill. I'm going to sit here and veto it in front of all of you. I'm doing this partly to continue the discussion as we move forward into the 21st century, to not look backwards to the past and say, how do we protect it? But how do we continue to move forward using technology to better serve and meet all of our needs? I've asked Donna Leong, our corporation counsel, to draft a bill that we'll be sending down to the council in the next few days that will level the playing field and allow transportation companies to do whatever they want as long as there's disclosure and as long as the public is protected. And then the public can make that choice that they want as to whether they want to get into a traditional taxi cab or into a ride-sharing company. And I wanted to talk about this a little bit more. You know, for me, it is about leveling the playing field for all private transportation companies. Whatever your model is, we want to let you operate in the fairest way possible. But we want to protect consumers. And that means, one, the vehicle is inspected, but more importantly, that the driver has been vetted, that there's been a background check, there's been a national background check, that it goes back 7 years, so that you know that your daughter or your wife or your grandmother, when they get into one of these types of vehicles, that you know the driver's been vetted as much as possible. And then we're going to look at two different models that you can work, that this bill will talk about. One is an end of ride, which is your traditional taxi cab, where you pay at the end of the ride, where Sherry Kajiwara, who's here, would be setting the maximum per mile fare. So you know when you get in, this is the maximum you're going to pay. And the other way is the flat rate pricing that you know in advance before you get into the vehicle. And we're going to allow taxi cabs to do that too. So you could be a Uber Lyft type model, or you'd be a taxi cab model. And as long as you disclose upfront what the end ride fare is going to be, you can operate under that model.
We asked Uber's representative to speak on our program. The company sent us this written statement from Tabitha Chow, Uber's senior operations manager for Hawaii. Quote, Mayor Caldwell's veto protects consumer choice and earning opportunities on Oahu. We look forward to continuing to serve our community. To get the cab company's reaction, we spoke earlier this morning with Howard Higa, CEO of the cab.
This is not an issue between taxis or ride-sharing companies. This was a bill really set up for the consumer protection and safety. For example, this bill basically had four things in it. One was basically for medical checks for the drivers. We always felt that, you know, you can't have a driver that's medically not fit to be driving around passengers, whether he's a cancer patient or if he's a real bad diabetic or even on dialysis. And we've heard testimonies from some of these drivers that are on dialysis, that are cancer patients, that have bad diabetes. And to their admission, they've actually fainted. And I'm saying, well, that's the reason why we're pushing to have medical checks. It's not against a ride-sharing company, but this is for a betterment of the industry. The second thing was we talked about is on this bill is vehicle markings. If there is no vehicle markings on the cars, how can there be any enforcement? Because if they have no commercial markings on this thing, whether they're an Uber car or a Lyft car, how does HPD know that they're in violation of anything? They're just another car passing by, like another resident. So we always felt that if you're going to be a commercial driver, you should have some sort of markings on that thing. So at least the law enforcement can say, okay, you're not parking in the right area, or you get ticketed. Taxi cabs, for example, have domes. They also have vehicle markings. So it's easy for the HPD to say, okay, listen, cab 445 or whatever the markings is, you're illegal, and we can catch you, and we can go to the database and find out who you really are. So we have that. The second thing is the third thing is the database. We always pushed to have the city at one time, for all these years, for 50 years, the city always did have a database for all the taxi drivers. This past year, they took that all away. They said, we're not going to deal with that. That's not our responsibility. So the database is to be held by the individual cab companies. And they even made it easier. It says, you know what? If you have more than two cabs, taxis, you can have your own company. Just pay us $1,000 registration fee, and you can have ABC Taxi. And I'll tell you what, on top of that, you do all your background checks. You do all your testing. You do all your English exams. You do all your database. You keep your database. And some people may have on flashcards on their database. They're scattered all over the place. There is no comprehensive database that the city has right now.
Essentially, what you're saying is that you, as a taxi company, are held to a higher standard.
I believe we are held to the highest standard, probably one of the highest in the United States.
And you want that to continue?
We want it to continue. And there's a reason why these lawmakers, for 50 years, always had huge regulations, rules and regulations on taxi companies, because it's for the consumer protection. We have never, as an industry, and we are the largest in town, so I know this, but we have never pushed back and said we want lesser regulations. And I did talk to the mayor about this, and I said, you know, we need to level the playing field for any incoming company coming into the transportation industry here. We need to maintain the same regulations and the same protection that the city has had for 50 years.
Isn't the mayor using some of that same language, leveling the playing field, with this sort of middle path proposal of having you folks, you taxi companies, adopt some of the same methods as the ride-sharing companies?
Well, I understand that too, but we have a different modus operandi. Our business model does not do that. You cannot have a Chinese restaurant do what McDonald's does, for example. They're not equipped for it. We're not equipped for it. We don't have an application, for example, the algorithms that the ride-sharing companies use, at a click of a finger, that we can make fares rise to two times or three times the fare. Our business model was built on the basics of taxis. So you cannot turn a taxi into a ride-sharing company, and that's what the mayor wants to do. That's impossible. We don't have the infrastructure for that. Why wouldn't these ride-share companies come in, and the mayor says, well, why don't you operate like a taxi and force that on them? And they're saying, oh, that's just old-fashioned. We have been around for over 50 years, and there's nothing wrong. The old saying goes, if it's not broke, don't try and fix it.
Well, that's the argument that the ride-sharing companies use to advance their business model. We are cheaper. We are more effective. We're faster. We can take out my phone and find out where the car is, and they'll tell me it'll be with me in 3 minutes, even show me the path that car is taking. Wouldn't that be advantageous to you?
Well, no. What the thing is that why would we change our model if, number one, at the end of the day, if you calculate the surge pricing and let's say there's supposedly lower fares, you add that together and do quick math and get an average, and I'll guarantee you they're probably as much as taxis or even more when you throw in their type of calculations. It just seems like they're cheaper, but if you throw in their surge pricing and you throw in their regular fares and you add them together and divide it by two, you're going to find out that they might be higher than taxis. And that's debatable, and I understand that. The second thing is that the mayor uses quote about taking surge pricing is it eliminates a 45 minute wait. I said, I've been in this business for over 20 years. The cab, if it's going to take 45 minutes, he just doesn't show up, you know, and that never really happens. As a matter of fact, because of our GPS things, we get there before the customer is even ready. So he'll pick up the phone, and through GPS, if anybody understands what GPS is, it'll ping the nearest cab in the block. So, for example, if the guy calls and he's in, let's say he's in Mililani, wherever he is, and that cab happens to be right there, he could be there in a half a minute.
Howard, what would you like to see happen? You know, ride-sharing companies aren't going to pack up and go away, and you don't want to pack up and go away. You're concerned about this middle path the mayor has offered. What would you like to see happen here?
Well, I agree. As a matter of fact, I think the ride sharing idea is great. I think it's a good model, and it's another option for transportation.
You can coexist.
I that's what I always wanted to do. I have talked to Uber. I've talked to the Lyft people. And I believe that they're not going to go away. And I don't believe we are going to go away. So the only way we can operate in this town together is we need to come up with ideas that we can coexist.
Howard Higa is the president and CEO of the CAB. We should note that he's also a member of the Hawaii Public Radio Board. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, is the American public ready to embrace authoritarian models of government? But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, his name came up in yesterday's discussion of North and South Korea when we were reminded that this key figure in Korean history spent much of his life in Hawaii. He was born in 1875 in what is now North Korea and learned English and became a Christian at a Methodist school. He was a passionate advocate of Korean independence from an early age and spent years in prison when still a young man for his efforts to free Korea from Japanese domination. He went to Princeton, where he became the first Korean national to win an advanced degree from an American university. He returned to Korea in 1910, the year in which his country was annexed by Japan. He immigrated to Hawaii and spent the next 30 years advocating for Korean independence. Decades later, he would become the first president of the Republic of Korea, and today we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Spring Awakening, a musical exploring the journey from adolescence to adulthood, this Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
We've been hearing discussions of the limits of presidential power for decades. It comes to a head in one way or another with each new presidency. The current administration is not the first to test the limits of that power, but it does so in an increasingly volatile environment, one in which the press, the traditional watchdog, is being threatened as never before. Has the American public's attitude toward authoritarian government softened as its regard for democracy has declined? Neil Milner, The Conversation's contributing editor, has more. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I sort of pose that question, have we become more tolerant of authoritarian government? Maybe we've become less tolerant.
Well, it's kind of mixed, and a lot of this is based on two surveys that have been sponsored by the Democracy Study Group, a very large sample, that looked at the question of sort of general attitudes toward democracy by asking people about various kinds of oversight, the press and Congress, the rule mm-hmm. of law. Another one was addressed a little bit more to questions that may deal with democracy in general. And what we find about authoritarianism and democracy is a kind of good news, bad news thing. If you look at people's attitudes toward democracy, now this is based on a poll that was taken in 2017. So in some ways it may be a lot influenced by Trump. We really don't know yet. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the upside that is toward democracy, first of all, if you just ask a general question, a high percentage of people still support democracy. If you look at what's happening internationally, democracy is actually doing pretty well. And if you look at the surveys here, you discover that most people do okay on some aspects of oversight that we associate with democracy. The other side, the more, and one other thing about authoritarianism, it appears that among certain groups, support for our kind of authoritarian government in the United States have dropped since Trump. And as one of the writers of the study said somewhere else, that maybe Trump is giving authoritarianism a bad name. That's all pretty preliminary. The downside, that is the pessimistic side about democracy, is that if you look closely at these surveys, the survey, for example, that asks people each about five different things that are associated with kind of democratic oversight of a president, only a bare majority support all five of them. So the authors of the study say, on the surface, democracy looks okay, but there is this fragility here because a lot of things, and it differs with groups.
Well, you just raised the question of whether people know what it is.
Well, that's always a question that you have trouble with in when you look at these things. And to the credit of this, of these surveys, especially the one that asks about democracy, because they ask specific questions about what about the press having more or less oversight, about Congress having more or less, they focused it a little bit more. And that's why, to me, it's a more important piece of work than if you ask people, do they support democracy generally? So you get a little bit of context here. But democracy, you're right, it carries a very kind of strong, symbolic, positive word that you really have to tap into it a little bit more.
In the last couple of weeks, we've seen our chief executive, in effect, pick a fight with our close ally Canada, a democratic government on our northern border, and you know, have high praise for the leaders of North Korea and Russia.
Well,
and you wonder what influence that's going to have on the American
public. You're absolutely right. This kind of thing is a work in progress. And let's take one step back. These surveys are not simply about Trump. That is the kind of ferment over democracy and having some differences of opinion about civil liberties. That's been around for a while. Trump introduces something very immediate and something that is quite different. He's definitely a norm buster. That's kind of a polite way to put it. And he certainly does have authoritarian tendencies. Now, if you put that up against the public opinion right now, it seems like public opinion is still kind of holding its own against that. And as I said, there's a little bit of discomfort, more discomfort than you think. But here's the issue. Part of what authoritarianism depends on is the authoritarianism is more likely to develop to the extent to which institutions that are supposed to be oversighting the executive, the president, act as a kind of counterweight. Mm-hmm. That's simply not happening right now. You can watch how it's happened on immigration. You can watch generally. That is, the Republicans in Congress do not act like that. So part of what may be going on here is a kind of sense of how people are going to change their views of democracy in regard to Trump, especially Trump's base. If you have people, if you have someone behaving in a norm-busting manner, like the president, and you have a base that's generally pretty loyal to him. You know, he's got his approval rates, some measures have gone down, but there's still that base that supports
him. He's got a solid 40%.
He's got a solid 40, 41%. But when faced with assuming these people generally have a pro attitude toward democracy, and they do, Trump supporters are a little less likely than others, assuming that there's this kind of democratic sentiment, when you're faced as a voter between someone that you're loyal to, the president, and these kind of abstract ideas, what happens? And that's what we don't know yet. That's what really is in a state of flux, the extent to which Trump's behavior will be seen as a threat to authoritarian, a threat to democracy on the basis of people who now support him.
So the lessons of history have shown us that there are some short-term benefits to having an authoritarian government, the old line about the trains run on time.
I guess that's right, although this country's never been very train-oriented. It seems like democracies are most fragile and authoritarian governments are more likely to take over for democracy to the extent to which democracies are economically fragile. So Nazi Germany at a certain time, the optimists about democracy here say, look, the liberal order, not liberals in a political sense, the liberal rule of all order in a relatively wealthy place has been able to overcome authoritarian tendencies. And that's what I mean about everything being in play. That's a kind of general historical statement. But how much Trump is going to be and the Republican Party particularly, because they're really key in this, are going to affect this is still up in the air.
Well, what I meant about the trains running on time is people embrace authoritarian governments when it suits their short term.
Yeah, that's right. Now, our system of government, which we liberals railed about as being gridlocked during the Obama administration, but are in many ways very happy for gridlock now because it stops the Republicans. You have to remember that our system of government is really designed to encourage gridlock, because that's what the separation of powers does. That reduces the power of authoritarianism, but there's a cost.
That's what Churchill meant by saying democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the others.
That's right, which in a sense is a cop-out unless democracy is really working well.
Thanks very much, Neil.
Sure.
Neil Milner is the Conversations contributing editor of our regular segment, The Long View, and you can find links to more information about today's segment on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Aloha International Piano Festival, featuring Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and Ravel's Bolero on three pianos, 4 p.m. this Sunday at UH Orvis Auditorium. AlohaPianoFestival.com.
Tales of tragic love, of bullies and bears, and of the goddess Pele? Hear all of them told by master storyteller Jeff Gere in HPR's intimate Atherton studio on Saturday, the 23rd. Enjoy fresh tales on an old tongue by calling 955-8821 during business hours or going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Recent polls of Hawaii Republican Party members show John Carroll, an 88-year-old candidate who has run five times before, as its front-runner for the gubernatorial nomination. To party members who are trying to make Hawaii's perennial also-rans into viable contenders in today's election, this is a troubling sign, as Stuart Yelton tells us in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
I got your name wrong. Sorry, Stuart Yelton.
That's okay. People have called me worse.
I'm sure. Well, especially because you cover politics, right? And you know, John Carroll is you know, the classic American model of the perennial candidate. He's always going to run, and he's run it five times before. And to a party trying to infuse itself with new blood, that's kind of what your piece is about, isn't it?
It is. So we have John Carroll, as you mentioned. He's run a number of times. He's 88 years old. He's got a platform based a lot on overturning the Jones Act, which is also the Merchant Marine Act, that it sort of increases costs of goods shipped to Hawaii. We have another interesting candidate, Andrea Tupola, is a sharp contrast. She's 37 years old. She's a music teacher and is a very energetic candidate who's in a lot of ways a polar opposite of John Carroll. We have a third candidate, Ray LaRue, who's kind of in the middle. He's 56 years old. He's a one-time assistant school superintendent and a former Marine lieutenant colonel who ran the Marine One program, which transports the president by helicopter. So those are the three candidates, and we have to see which one, if any, can help revive the beleaguered Republican Party here.
When you look at the current state of the Republican Party, I have to say, Stuart, it seems odd that they've ever won the governor's office, and in fact did so quite recently. What has changed since Linda Lingle, for example?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the one thing we do know is President Trump got only 30% of the votes here, so it doesn't seem like the GOP is very popular. It really might be at a low point here. We only have five members in the legislature, none in the Senate, five in the House. So it really is at a low point right now.
What kind of fundraising challenges do Republicans face these days?
Well, we hear that it is hard to raise money. Representative Tupola has raised considerably more than John Carroll. But again, we only know these numbers as of December. One of the challenges or issues here is that we aren't going to find out the latest fundraising numbers until July, really close to the primary. That's another story and something we think needs to be looked at. But again, we have to see we have to wait till July to see what's happening.
By which time we'll be on the eve of the primary election. But I would expect, given the energy of behind her campaign, do you expect Tupola's numbers to increase?
Yeah, we do expect the poll numbers to increase. We just have to wait and see the next poll that comes out. We have to see. Again, she's been running a very active campaign and is a very engaging person and speaker.
Well, you just have to keep an eye on it, as with everything else in politics. Thanks very much, Stuart.
Thank you, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Spring Awakening, a musical exploring the journey from adolescence to adulthood, this Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
Given the recent diplomatic thaw between the U.S. and North Korea, it's easy to forget that these countries' leaders were threatening mutual annihilation only last year. As part of that escalation, the U.S. Missile Defense Agency began exploring the possibility of constructing a ground-based defensive radar system in Hawaii. And all this week, the U.S. Missile Defense Agency is holding public meetings in the communities near proposed building sites. The first one was last night at Sunset Elementary School on the North Shore, and the conversation's Ryan Finity was in attendance, brought back this report.
In the summer of 2017, as threats from both sides continued to fly, the commander of U.S. Pacific Command testified before the House Armed Services Committee.
My personal opinion is that we would be better served with a defensive Hawaii radar and interceptors in Hawaii.
Admiral Harry Harris has since been nominated to serve as the U.S. ambassador to South Korea and praised the recent diplomatic efforts by North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. But his sentiments about the need to increase Hawaii's missile defense infrastructure have turned into action. The U.S. Missile Defense Agency is exploring sites on Oahu for a homeland defense radar. Part of that process involves meeting with residents of nearby communities. There are three potential sites being evaluated, one on Ka'ena Point and two in the mountains above Oahu's North Shore. The MDA's Deputy Director, Rear Admiral John Hill, is in Hawaii this week to speak with community members. I caught him before last night's meeting at Sunset Elementary School.
Let me start off by just kind of reviewing the mission of the Missile Defense Agency. Three short points. The first one is building out reliability so that we have the confidence of the warfighters. And so it's important that everything works the first time. This is a no-fail mission for us. The second piece is building out capability and capacity. And capability and capacity isn't always just missiles. Most people think of missiles when we say capability or capacity. But the sensor piece is critically important because that's what starts the whole kill chain. In order for us to effectively defend the United States, we have to be able to see it first. And so the sensor is important, and that's what the HDRH brings to Hawaii, is that sort of sensing capability. And then our third piece is addressing the advanced threat, and that's really the driver behind this radar. So when I get into why we need the radar for Hawaii, the islands are protected today by the ground-based missile defense system. So the ground-based interceptors in Alaska and in California defend Hawaii, and they do it very well. And the combatant commanders know how to deploy the system. We know when it's going to activate. We understand how to detect, control, and engage. But what will happen over time is that threat will become more complex. And the complexity of that threat drives us to be able to look out a lot further from the target area. So if Hawaii is a target, then we want to be able to have the kind of energy and power and sensitivity to detect much earlier in the kill chain so that we can guide that missile to that intercept point further away from the islands. And so complexity is what drives that. And so the positioning of this radar is just a strategic significance to the United States.
So can you explain what specifically will this radar be doing in the chain of missile defense, going, starting from, say, there's a launch somewhere in the Eastern Asia to here?
Sure. Yeah, so the way the kill chain normally starts is we'll get help from overheads, right? So our space assets will normally catch the initial part of the launch. And then in order to really understand the track and where it's going, we pick it up by radar. And so today we transition right over to the radars. The radars really lock in on that track. We move from basically a simple detection to establishing a track. And once we have a track, they're all very complex. Anytime you put anything into space, there's space debris, there could be fuel debris, there could be interesting countermeasures that the adversaries might be using. And so this kind of radar allows you to see it a lot earlier, hand off from the radars that are in closer to the launch site. Could be ships in the area that are picking it up. Could be the sea-based X-band radar that we have today, but having a radar in Hawaii that detects out further and then picks out the lethal object or the reentry vehicle, that's what we want to be able to do, is pick that out early so that we can engage it with a ground-based interceptor.
Admiral Harry Harris, who is the former commander of Indo-Pacific Command, stated previously that one of his big concerns was that, not that the missile defense system was inadequate, but that it was capable of being overwhelmed by multiple targets. Is this radar going to help address that problem?
Absolutely. So when I say power and sensitivity, that immediately takes you into the world of being able to handle much larger raid sizes. And so that's an additional thing that you get from that kind of power and sensitivity, is the ability to handle raids.
And so to be clear, this project would just be building a radar. We're not talking about installing missiles in Hawaii at this time, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely not. There are no intentions from the Department of Defense or combatant commanders to put missiles anywhere on the islands. This is about that early part of the kill chain, detection, and doing the discrimination. And again, discrimination means picking out that reentry vehicle.
Early reports stated that the agency, the Missile Defense Agency, had a pretty lengthy list of possible sites for this radar. I think it was over 40, and it's now been narrowed down to just three. They're all on the north shore of Oahu. How did those three sites become the finalists for this radar?
Well, you know, we always get a lot of help when it comes down to siting, but it all starts with an analysis of alternatives. And so we look at performance first and what it means for operations. And so having it out far to the west was the first look. So we wanted to as much battle space as we could get. So that first western, and because we had a range out there, we had an existing set of radars out on the west coast of Kauai, there at the Pacific Missile Range Facility. So there's a lot of traction to look at that. But when we took a look at the impact to that range, we immediately started looking at other options out of that list of 46, and turns out that the sites on Oahu are very effective, gets us the kind of battle space that we need, and probably more likely in terms of location and acceptance by the local communities and by the state to have that radar located here in Oahu.
In building anything in Hawaii, there are kind of tend to be more cultural concerns, both just in terms of general development and disturbing of cultural sites. What steps is the agency taking to address those concerns that are raised by community members?
Well, you're in on the ground floor of any sort of, anytime you go in to establish a military site, the siting selection is very, very important, and the local community is very important. My mother grew up on this island, and so she used to tell me stories about different parts of the island and the ecology and the environment and things that had to be protected, ancient Hawaiian cultural things that need to be protected. And so I'm very sensitive to that. So we're starting in early, so we're a couple years out. We're going to go through the full environmental impact statement process, the full site selection. We're going to get feedback from the state, from the local communities before we proceed. So right now, the way the schedule lays out is, although we want to be able to field that radar in 2023, we don't start constructing until 2021, and that environmental impact statement will be complete prior to that. And so it's really the long pole to get to the radar, because we want to do it right, and we're starting early. These scoping sessions that we're doing with the local communities, very important, because we're going to get some feedback. We're going to hear things that maybe we haven't thought of yet, and that's just of great value as we go through the decision cycle.
There have been a few other high-profile projects in the state, the 30-meter telescope, for example, the Honolulu Rail project, that have suffered some delays and some setbacks due to construction issues and community opposition. Are you looking at those projects at all and trying to learn some lessons from them as you begin this process?
We are, and we have erected other sites, and we have a site that's ongoing now in Europe where we're struggling with construction. And the only way that you can come through that is to stay close to the local communities, work with the federal governments and the state governments in those areas, and just come to an agreement on what's the right thing to do. So starting earlier, if we could determine through this whole process that the three sites that we're assessing here in Oahu are absolutely the wrong sites, don't know. But that's all part of the process. And feedback, again, from the local communities, looking at everything from archaeology to environment to ecology, the whole bit, we've got to look at all of that. It's a pretty complex set of steps, but we're going to go through all of that step by step, and this is an important piece of it.
And Admiral, for those community members who aren't able to attend one of these three meetings that you're holding this week, what's your message? What would you like to say to them?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to say is within this scoping community discussion tonight, we have a Hawaiian language interpreter there that will take oral statements. We have forms that can be filled out on site by anybody that's visiting tonight, and they don't have to turn it in tonight. They can take their time on it. So if anybody wants to get to us, we can provide that contact information, and we can take those statements at any point. Any concerns, anything that we should be looking at that maybe we're not, we'd love to hear that.
More than 20 staff members from the Missile Defense Agency were on hand to address concerns and answer questions from local residents. Here's what a few of those residents had to say.
Well, it's a start. I've been involved with many EIS processes and public scoping meetings, and it's a start. It's a very long process, but tonight is the first of three, as you folks know, and it was very good, informative, and, you know, it's an opportunity where they can come, the public can come and get more educated about the project itself, and then from there they can go from, you know, pros and cons. My part that I will be very sensitive to is the cultural aspects of both site locations. Like I said, this is the early stages. We're getting to meet all the different players, and we'll go from there.
I'm opposed to the installation of yet another military installation. And the military already controls 85,718 acres on Oahu alone. And I was just told by more than one military specialist here that Oahu is already well protected. So that given, I don't know how or why they can justify 160 acres on this island, especially since there's such a large population, the whole North Shore behind it. And if key radar stations were to be attacked by another country, that would make the whole North Shore a bigger target than it already is. So I have that concern. And someone just said, a military person just said that it'll make us safer. I don't believe that. I fear that it'll make us less safe. And especially given that we're already well protected, I do not think we need another military installation.
It's a beginning. The most important part is to find out how these agencies actually maintain and care for the properties that may eventually come back to Hawaii. Yeah? So our hope is that we have an opportunity to have clear discussion, you know, and then help them understand where they are in relation to our national treasures. Yeah, so both what we term as Kua Okala and O'io are these specific areas where they look at trying to do this program right now. So we take the first steps, come to the meeting, listen to what they get to say, and then eventually try to get back on the land to get a better understanding for them too as to, you know, how to proceed if it's that important to do so.
That was Thomas from Mokulaia, Krista from the North Shore, and Tom from Wahiwa. If all goes according to plan, the agency will break ground on the new radar site in 2020 with plans to be operational by 2023. From the North Shore, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
That story was about the Missile Defense Agency, which will be holding public meetings tonight at Keihi Lagoon Memorial Park in Honolulu, tomorrow evening at Waianae High School. The public can also submit written comments until July 23rd. The issue is that the U.S. Missile Defense Agency is looking into the possibility of constructing ground-based defensive radar here in Hawaii. They're looking at possible sites for that and holding public meetings in the communities affected. We'll have details for those events posted along with this story at our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
In today's backyard quiz, we told you about a man who spent much of his career as a political activist here in Hawaii, and would go on to become the first president of the Republic of Korea. He was an Ivy League-educated Christian who saw education as a key to independence for his country from Japan, which annexed Korea in 1910. That's when the man we're thinking of came to Hawaii, where he continued to agitate for Korean independence. He was later elected in absentia to the presidency of the Provisional Government, a government in exile whose headquarters were in Shanghai. His relationship with America helped him ascend to power in the years after the Second World War, and in 1948, he became President of the Republic of Korea, a post to which he was re-elected in 1952, 1956, and 1960. But in the spring of 1960, accusations of corruption sent him into exile, and Syngman Rhee died in 1965 in Honolulu. Well, Wayne Gow from Honolulu was the first to get that right. Congratulations, Wayne. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for students' summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Today's world is filling up with stateless refugees, and few of us can imagine what their lives are like, but Isaac Shapiro can. He's 87 years old now and an American citizen, but he spent the early years of his life in the Jewish immigrant community of Harbin in Manchuria, China. In the years leading up to the Second World War, he and his family lived in Japan as stateless foreigners. He spent the war years in Tokyo, only to be adopted by an American family and brought to Hawaii in his teens. It's a remarkable life story, as told in his memoir, Idoko, growing up a stateless foreigner in wartime Japan.
It was a life that was punctuated by change, unexpected events. I was born into a stateless Russian-Jewish family in Tokyo. Shortly after my birth, my parents separated, and my mother took my three brothers and myself back to Harbin, where her father lived. I was only 6 months old, so I wasn't fully aware of what was going on. So my first impressions of life were from living in Harbin, China. I didn't speak a word of Chinese, so...
What did you speak in your
Only family? Russian.
In the home?
Russian.
What years were those?
1931 to 1936. Mm-hmm. And it was a completely foreign environment, but I was comfortable because I had a loving family, my grandfather, my mother, his daughter, and we had a governess, and I had three brothers. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't at all lonely or...
So it was a comfortable life, but an essentially stateless one.
A stateless life in a totally foreign environment.
Yeah.
I didn't go to school those years in Harbin. I first went to school in Japan when we went back in 1936, when my parents got back together, and I started my school career at a British school, Anglican school in Yokohama. Didn't know a word of English. My mother came with me to school every day, and she was a teacher at the school, music teacher. And then one day I said, look, I don't need you anymore. I can navigate.
Was she acting as a translator in those early years?
Yes.
So is that how you learned English, essentially?
Yes, through in kindergarten.
In situations with
where I had to speak English or I couldn't communicate with anybody.
Yeah.
And, of course, I made friends and played around, and one thing led to another.
Had you acquired some Chinese?
No, not a word.
How about Japanese?
Oh, I learned Japanese very quickly because you couldn't live in Japan without speaking Japanese. It's just
now, what years are we talking about now?
1936 to 1946 when I emigrated and came to the United States, to Hawaii, actually.
Those are pretty pivotal years in the Empire of Japan.
They certainly were.
What did you sense about what was happening, was in the air in Japan at that time?
In the late 30s, until Pearl Harbor, we knew about the war between China and Japan. And, of course, we learned what was going on in Europe in the late 30s, the expansion of Hitler Germany. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of refugees coming in whom we met. And, in fact, at one point, my father, who spoke English quite well, was used by all the Jewish refugees who were transiting to America.
Russian Jewish?
Poland, Germany,
Egypt,
Hungary, from everywhere.
Sure.
And they were looking to get visas to go to America, but they couldn't speak English, so he was a cellist and a professor of music and conductor. Mm-hmm. But he took time out to help these people. He would go to the consulate with them and translate for them.
Was music kind of a passport for your parents in a foreign land?
Very much so. Everywhere they went, they were received quite well because of their musical talent.
Because I was wondering if, absent that, what it would have been like for a Russian in Japan
very
in 1936.
Very rough. But they were received very well by the Japanese, who were importing Western music. The NHK, which is a well-known symphony, was started when my father was first there in the 1920s.
Importing Western music even as they were going to war against
us. Exactly. In fact, they imported Western opera in the 19th century, but they were importing all sorts of cultural elements. I mean, the legal system, as a lawyer, I studied it.
Sure.
And the Japanese legal system was really given a fresh start in the late 19th century, first with the importation of the German civil code, and then in the early 20th century they imported the British law.
How old were you when war broke out?
I was, December 8th, 1941. I was not quite 11 years old, so I was...
So you're a kid growing up in a country that is now at war with people
Correct.
Who look kind of like you. What was that like?
Well, we had a variety of nationalities in Japan, and the Japanese government sorted us all out. There were enemy aliens, and there were German allies, and there were stateless people like ourselves who were in...
You really didn't fall into any category?
No, we didn't fall into any category, and because they were musicians and taught, well, my father was a professor at a Japanese music school, so they more or less accommodated themselves and treated us respectfully.
But that's pretty unusual to have been able to have been in that position.
Yes, because a lot of other foreigners weren't treated so well.
I would think so.
Yeah. And in fact, we knew people who were interned or imprisoned or expelled from Japan. Mm-hmm. There were all these ships, exchange ships with Americans exchanged for Japanese who came from America back to Japan.
Prisoner exchanges, yeah. Well, now the war ends. It's 1945. You're now a teenager.
I'm 14 years old.
In a conquered nation that is now ruled by an American, by a consul.
Exactly.
Douglas MacArthur. What was that like?
Well, it was a wonderful experience because first thing I did, I was at that point when the war ended, I was in Karuizawa, which was a kind of a refugee camp where my parents had sent me along with my brothers to get away from the bombings. And I then decided to go down to Yokohama and greet the troops. And I didn't tell my parents where I was going. I just took off, left home, if you will, and haven't been living at home since I was 14. Because after that, I became acquainted with this Marine colonel who brought me to America.
Is that what made you become an American citizen?
Yes. I was more or less adopted by this Marine colonel who was married but had no children, was stationed in Japan in charge of a Marine air group, and then he was transferred to Hawaii. And so the first place he brought me to was Hawaii because, I mean, he was from Arkansas, but he never lived there.
By that time, in your mid-teens, was it a question of his saying, do you want to come live with me, become an American?
Yes, and he came to my parents and said, I'd like to take this boy with me. And I'd been his driver and interpreter, drove his Jeep around.
How did your parents feel about that?
Well, they had mixed feelings. In the first place, they didn't like to see their children leave at that age, but on the other hand, they were not in very good straits, and it was hard to take care of a bunch of kids. So they more or less allowed us to do what we wanted. I had two of the brothers had gone back to China in 1944, so they weren't around. There were only three of us at the war's end. And my older brother went to work for the U.S. Army, and eventually he came to America, but much later, and on his own. I was the one that was mentored and adopted and brought back.
What made you want to write your book?
I'd been urged to write something, and I never had the time until I retired in 2001. And people said, well, now you have nothing else to do. Why don't you write your book? So I did. It took me a long time.
Isaac Ike Shapiro is the author of Idoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan. He's 87 years old. He's an American citizen who spent the early years of his life in the Jewish immigrant community of Harbin in Manchuria, China. And in the years leading up to the Second World War, he and his family lived in Japan as stateless foreigners. He was eventually adopted by an American family and brought to Hawaii as a teenager.
I'm Ryan Rosala.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn how the invasive albizia tree can be used to build much-needed housing, an idea that earned the first Wood Innovation Grant from the U.S. Forest Service.
We'll hear from the University of Hawaii's Office of Sustainability and the Hawaii Department of Forestry and Wildlife.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
My name is Kat Lynn Hurtubise, and I am with Gourmet Events Hawaii. We have been an underwriter for Hawaii Public Radio since 2009. The experience in being an underwriter is just a sense of joining a really warm and powerful family. There are many companies that I admire and respect who are also underwriters, and I feel like I'm in very good company by choosing this year after year.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll sit down for a call-in show. We'll be taking your calls from around the islands, looking at the current state of Hawaii Island as it deals with the disruptions caused by the Kilauea lava flow. Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're found on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook, and I'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.